Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name is John, and this week we have the President and CEO of SaverLife, Lee Phillips, here to talk with us about COVID-19 and saving money for working families. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. All right, let's get going. With me this week is my co-host, Steve.
Hey, John, good to not see you in person.
Yeah, good to not see you as well. And our special guest for this week, the President and CEO of SaverLife, Lee Phillips. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Well, let's get started just with what is SaverLife and what do they do?
Well, in normal times, and we know that these are definitely not normal times that we're experiencing right now, SaverLife is a nonprofit organization that helps working Americans to save money and establish a habit of saving. So we're really focused on the 40%+ of American households that could not cover a $400 emergency without going into debt. And obviously we're seeing the ramifications of that level of financial instability really play out in very significant ways right now. So SaverLife is a financial technology nonprofit, and we make saving money engaging, rewarding, and fun. And we do that by encouraging people to save regularly by offering prizes, cash matches, and other rewards for saving. We also provide financial coaching content, user forums, a lot of content and resources on our website that's focused on really helping people tackle some pretty serious financial challenges.
One of your products is a platform for price-linked savings. Can you explain what that is?
Absolutely. So SaverLife actually started out doing match savings. So SaverLife was formerly called Earn. We've actually been around since 2001, helping low-income families save money and build assets. And a number of years ago, the organization decided to take a pretty big pivot from a direct service organization helping people here in the Bay Area and serving maybe 600 to 1,000 people a year, to looking at how we could leverage technology to tackle a much bigger problem, which is the fact that, you know, 50%+ of us are struggling financially. So we started out actually doing small cash matches for saving. So the idea was that if you saved every month, you would receive a $10 reward for doing that. But there was a couple things that weren't working out so well with that approach. First off, when you're trying to reach scale, even $10 a month is a pretty seen as a pretty small amount, but it's actually quite significant. But also we didn't find it to be as engaging. So we started to experiment with price-linked savings, and we worked with another nonprofit called Commonwealth, who's really pioneered this approach across the US and in credit unions and other places. And what we wanted to know, what would happen if instead of getting a guaranteed monthly match, you were offered the chance to win prizes instead. So we piloted that probably about 2 years ago now. And it went so well that we decided actually to switch to that for our core offering to clients. And so now we do a variety of different savings challenges, because what we find is that people's financial situations are different, right? Like some people make money consistently every week or every 2 weeks. Some people, that picture is a lot more volatile. Some folks can afford to save $100 a month, but a lot of our people can only afford to save maybe, $5 to $20 a month. And we wanted to serve all people. So what we found is that offering prizes instead of matches has been really great in terms of engaging people and encouraging them to save. So I can tell you a little bit more about how that works. So we have a couple of challenges that we are running right now on the platform. So one of them is called Scratch and Win. And so you save money, and every time you save a minimum of $5 a week, you get a digital scratch card that's emailed to you. And then you have the chance to win, different levels of cash prizes for doing that. We've also been experimenting with time-limited challenges. So the idea that a lot of our clients don't make the same amount of money in every paycheck. So how can we help people save when they have more money? So we're doing these race to 100 and race to 500 challenges, where for a 6 to 8 week period of time, we're encouraging people to get to that $100 or $500 threshold with prizes for for hitting those different limits. And then we've also just wrapped up our tax time challenge. So we really want to encourage people to take advantage of these kind of windfall moments when they have a large amount of money coming in, and tax season for lower income families is typically a time when they see a large infusion of cash. So we encourage people to take a pledge to save their refund, and you can win prizes for pledging and then for saving that refund. And across the board, we found those approaches to be pretty effective in getting people to save money.
Yeah, I love that gamification kind of ideas that can turn like a negative habit or that kind of addictive behavior into something positive. Mm-hmm. You know, people are playing lottery or, you know, maybe we need to open a savings casino.
I think the people get that proposition, right? That it is kind of the no-lose lottery because you win regardless, right? You win because you're building that savings habit. And it kind of gives people that added incentive to get going. So we joke a lot about, half joke about the fact that saving is something that everybody thinks that they need to do and knows they should be doing more of, but everyone wants to start doing it tomorrow, right? Like people don't necessarily want to start doing it today. It's, you know, it's like exercise or whatever, right? It's always like tomorrow is going to be different. But most often, you know, tomorrow isn't that different than today. So what are the things that we can do to get people to take that that first step? And, you know, winning a prize, we find if someone wins, they're 100% more likely to save again the next week. So for people that win, it has a really great effect. And for people who play the game, their savings rates increase. About 30% of them go on to increase that savings habit. So it's been a great way for us to really engage people and also to find that path to scale that's a little bit more affordable than paying everybody.
I wouldn't be surprised if some economists are going to start to approach you about doing studies on what kind of games work, what kind of behaviors are effective, what things don't work, that sort of thing. Have people approached you? And are you finding that some incentives or games are much more effective than others?
So yes, we get approached quite a lot by different groups of people wanting to learn from our data. And, you know, of course we're a nonprofit, right? So ultimately we're focused on doing right by people, encouraging people to take those steps to change things they can change, but we're also focused on systemic change, right? So we're looking at not just what do you do as an individual, what actions do you take, but what is the environment and the system in which you can take those actions? And for a lot of lower income working people, that environment of that system is just not rewarding in the way that it is for higher income people. So we get a lot of requests for research. So on the programmatic side, really looking at those individual level interventions. So thinking about, you know, what does make people save more? What are, you know, the different things you can do? And we've done some fun experiments. We did one where we tested text messages, encouraging text messages from three different personas. One was Mother Teresa, one was Michelle Obama, and one was Mr. T. And I'll let you guys guess which one do you think is most effective in getting people to save more money?
Ooh, I know I have a preference. Yeah. I'll go with Mr. T.
Same here, actually.
And you are both correct. So Mr. T, we did have to explain to some of the younger people on our team who Mr. T is.
Now I feel old.
Yeah, exactly. But you are also correct. That's wisdom, right? So that message from Mr. T, which was, you know, was, I pity the fool that doesn't save money, was impactful in getting people to save. So we're able to run a lot of different experiments. We are working with a professor from Columbia University that's interested in whether or not your personality has an impact on savings. And so we've integrated the kind of, I think it's called the Big Five Personality Survey into Saver Life, so that when you onboard, you have the option to take that survey. And now they're looking to compare that with transactional data to see if they see a correlation between your personality type and your savings behavior. And then of course, the next step of that would be like, okay, well, how do we build tools that work for not just different circumstances, but different personalities? So there's a lot of interest on that side of things. The ability for us to, experiment obviously is great. But then again, also as a nonprofit, nonprofits are much more open and prone to sharing data and information than perhaps our colleagues in the private sector. So we also get a lot of requests for data, looking at things, like transactional level data on households. So looking at things like social policy, like increased tax refunds, how does that affect families, people who've received public benefits, what are the impacts on them? So it really kind of runs the gamut, and it's a service that we're happy to be able to provide.
So you were founded as Earn and changed your name to SaverLife last year in 2019, but your business model is the same. You work with consumers directly, and you also white label your platforms and your products, mostly to credit unions. How has that evolved in the past couple of years?
It's been a very windy road, I can tell you that much. You know, I think there are a lot of great ideas there about how we can help people with their financial situations. But there's not always in the nonprofit world a lot of great infrastructure to really build on. And so we have developed this kind of three-pronged approach to our work. So the first is the direct-to-consumer platform that we were just talking about at saverlife.org that anyone can join in the US. But then we also see this great need for a technology solution that can help employers, credit unions, other financial institutions, and other nonprofits to encourage their clients, their employees, their membership to save money. So under our SaverLife Solutions brand, we actually white label our technology in different ways. So with credit unions, we just did a big pilot with Patelco that wanted to experiment with prize link savings to see if that increased deposit rates into savings accounts for their membership. But we also do a fair amount of work with employers. So we have a number of employers, including Levi Strauss and Taylor Brand and a number of others who want to help their employees, oftentimes retail, warehouse, distribution center kind of employees, to build a savings habit. And so in those cases, they're actually generous employers stepping up to match the savings of their employees dollar for dollar. So we do still run a match version of SaverLife that is available white label and also at the community campaign level. So we also do some specific geographic campaigns as well with different partners. So there's a lot of ways that we can work with folks. And then the third kind of leg of that stool is the research and advocacy work that we were just discussing.
So what have been some of the challenges in expanding your service?
Well, I think transforming a 20-something, well-known, well-respected direct service nonprofit into a national fintech is not
been a mouthful.
Challenge. Yeah, exactly. It's a bit of a mouthful. So I would say, gosh, so many. I mean, like when you're mission driven, right, you're trying to solve really hard problems. And, you know, we in the tech world that, you know, you hear a lot of talk about product market fit, but we're in some ways looking for market product fit, right? Like we have a group of people that we want to help and we're not going to move off that, right? So like that doesn't change for us. And so really then the challenge is finding the right tools and things that fit to work for a pretty diverse group of people, right? This is not a one-size-fits-all solution. And our clients face a lot of challenges. You know, it's extremely difficult for people to save money and to get ahead financially in this country. And there's a lot of reasons for that. So I think, you know, big picture, you're always kind of battling those bigger systemic issues that people face in their daily lives. So that's one thing. I think trying to emerge a technology solution funded by philanthropy is definitely a challenge. You know, it's not like we can go out and raise large sums of money from venture capitalists. Like we have to rely on our donors, many of whom are great. I mean, all of whom are great, are large institutional funders. But isn't always necessarily set up to invest in an environment where things change quite rapidly. So I think those are definitely some of the challenges, trying to obviously stay true to the mission and what you do, but then also trying to weave together the resources to put something out there that really has impact.
So there's those challenges, and what has changed for you and, you know, your environment that you're working in now in the age of COVID-19?
Well, I'm seeing a lot more of my dining room than I was seeing previously. You know, I think a lot has changed and not a lot has changed kind of at the same time. I mean, I think organizations like SaverLife who are working with individuals every day, this is our issue, right? The economic side of this crisis and that's coming from the public health crisis. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that we try and prepare people for. No one's ever, I think, imagined or seen anything of this magnitude. But the reality is that a lot of people, millions of people in this country, are unprepared for any kind of a financial emergency, you know, whether or not that be something in your own life, something in your region, you know, hurricane, wildfire, something like that. And now, of course, this global pandemic. So I think that while we as a team have managed to segue into working remotely as a tech-driven organization, we don't see clients in the office. So that's been okay. And then we've also just been looking at how can we do our best and highest work right now. And so we have taken another turn. Our platform was already designed to pay out cash rewards and in the form of prizes and cash matches. So we've actually developed that further and have been raising money and sending out cash to people in need because we know that so many people are really suffering right now. They've lost all of their income very, very suddenly. Those government benefits that are supposed to offset that haven't really, are just now beginning to show up in people's bank accounts. And so we've had this moment, and this will, you know, continue, where people are in very, very precarious situations without income, without savings, and without additional benefits. So we actually turned on a dime and built a cash distribution platform pretty rapidly, and are now working with another nonprofit partner, Neighborhood Trust, to combine their financial coaching services with our payment services. And I've been raising a fair amount of money to get out the door in the form of cash payments.
You mentioned fundraising, but it's different from what we typically cover, which is mostly VC and private markets. So is the majority of your operating budget coming from philanthropies and corporate partners?
Yeah, so as a 501c3, the majority of our funding comes from philanthropies. So it's a mixture, in our case, mostly corporate, some foundation donors. The big funders of Save Our Life are, you know, companies you've heard of, MetLife, Intuit, JPMorgan Chase, MasterCard, Prudential, you know, Capital One. Then we have funding from foundations, family foundations, local foundations, individuals. And then the white label work that we were discussing earlier, that's an earned revenue source for us. So we do have some earned revenue in the mix as well, which is great.
Yeah, it's interesting. You see so much of what struggling families are going through. If you could change one major policy, what would it be to help them?
You know, we just put out a paper about this, and we did a survey a few months ago, about a year ago, of California members, and we asked that very question of our membership, right? So what they think is more important, I think, than what I think. And the question was, we have a new governor in California at that time. What do you hope he does? What's one thing he could do that would most improve your economic situation? And the top answer across the board, which wasn't that surprising to me, was a more consistent work schedule. So one of the things that we don't talk about enough, we tend to look at things like annual household income or hourly wage, but what that doesn't tell you is the full picture of how much people's hours of work fluctuate paycheck to paycheck. So in our, we have, 250,000 plus members of Save Our Life. What we find is this, what we call income volatility, is so pervasive that about 70% of our membership's income goes up and down by about $1,000 a month, month over month over month. So when you're looking at that at a household level, like maybe you look at a household and you think, oh, you know, that household made $45,000, $50,000 last year, that's okay. But if one month they made $1,000 and the next month they made, $1,500, then the next month they made $800, then the next month they made $3,000, it becomes extremely difficult for families to navigate covering basic expenses, staying out of debt, and saving in that very, very volatile picture. And so you have seen some companies come out that are looking at income smoothing, so great companies like Even. You're seeing other companies who are doing these kind of, access your wages faster, kind of models, and those are, to be debated, the pros and cons of that. But really the underlying issue is that people just don't have consistent income. And what that means is that they can't, it's very difficult to stay on track with financial stability. So I think if there is one policy area that we should really be looking at very closely, It's how do you give people more consistent work schedules, and so that allows them to do things like access affordable childcare, maybe go back to school in their spare time, have a second job if they need that. And all of those things are very difficult, if not impossible, to do if your work changes your hours every single week and sometimes day to day.
That's really interesting. I love that you guys are looking at the systemic issues also. And there's been some good change in this space, right? I think Starbucks maybe did away with their algorithmic scheduling practices 3 or 4 years ago, right?
Yeah, that's right. And and some communities have been taking action. And we're here in the Bay Area, and some of our local communities have passed ordinances that say, you can't hire more part-time workers without offering full-time employment to your existing workforce. Or you have to do more predictable schedules, right? You have to give weekly schedules or 2 weekly schedules to people so they know. And if you decide not to have them come into work, you still have to pay, a certain amount. So I think from in that policy landscape, there are things that we can do, and that this issue is really starting to hopefully get some more attention. But it is a really tough one for our clients.
Is that going backwards, or has it gone backwards a lot with the gig economy kind of companies?
Yes, that's a little hard to see in the data. I think what we see is more of an impact of that in certain areas. So definitely in the Bay Area and New York and more populated areas, we don't see as much activity. What's interesting is that we did a series of interviews kind of trying to get more information about this issue. And it's everybody, it's like retail workers, substitute teachers, nurses, adjunct professors. It was like all of these people that we were talking to. Some people you'd think like nursing, teaching, whatever would be pretty stable, but not necessarily. And so we just found that it's just very pervasive, and not just in platform-based gig economy, but this idea of really keeping people on these switching schedules is and not giving regular schedules to people has become a norm. And it's definitely, I can see why companies do it, but it's also very, very tough on the worker.
And of course, gig workers are not eligible for PPP. If you could change any aspect about the current government response, what would it be?
Gosh, that is a really big question. I think that we're seeing a lot of the kind of cracks just really, breaking wide open at this moment in time, right? You're seeing that what happens when, half of your families, half of your workforce couldn't even get through a week without income, let alone, what's looking like several months. So, I think that some things have been done right in the name of speed, right? So they kind of traded maybe a more complex approach for a faster one, which I think is good. Right now, people just need cash, and gig workers may not be getting PPP, but they are eligible for unemployment insurance, which they normally are not. But, I hope that as we work our way through this, that we kind of start to think, well, let's not get back to normal, because normal wasn't working. There are all these underlying issues that just aren't working for people. And I think that there's a lot that can be done there in looking at some of the policies that contribute to this kind of ongoing financial instability that people have, in their lives every day. And now, of course, it's just being really highlighted. So, I hope that they keep expanding access to resources for those that need it. I think there are some people who will be left out. And for those people, the consequences are really dire. We're talking about not being able to put food on the table, like very, very serious. And, we're seeing that and hearing that from our clients, that they're just, we don't have anything. And that's why we decided to focus, at least in the short term, into just getting cash into people's hands as quickly as we can, because we need to make sure that that our kids are taken care of.
Yeah, these are all really great ideas and some surprising things. I never would have guessed the payment stability would have been the number one thing. I would have guessed childcare or something else. And a lot of good you're doing with this good information as well. So we appreciate everything you're doing, and best of luck to you and Save Your Life. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much. And if anyone is interested about our work, you can read about us at saveyourlife.org. And we also have a lot of data coming out right now about the COVID-19 household economic impact. And so you'll find that there too.
Excellent.
Great. Thanks, Lee. Great. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, that was Lee Phillips, the president and CEO of Save Your Life at saveyourlife.org. Please hit subscribe to keep up with that and the latest in fintech news. See you next week.